And our newspaper coverage continues on this Monday, the 24th of August, 2026, on the Talking Information Center. Time now for the Boston Herald. With that, we say hello to Alicia.
Hello, everyone. Happy Monday. And here are your stories from today's Boston Herald. Closing arguments in Clancy trial expected this week. The Duxbury mother is accused of murdering her three children in 2023. By Colleen Cronin. As Lindsay Clancy's triple murder trial enters its fifth and potentially final week, witnesses for the prosecution's rebuttal are set to take the stand. Dr. Avram Mack, a psychiatrist called by the Commonwealth, will resume his testimony Monday morning. Clancy has admitted to killing her kids Cora, 5, Dawson, 3, and Kaylin, 8 months, in January 2023. That night, the night of January 24th, she'd asked her now ex-husband, Patrick Clancy, to pick up a medicine at CVS for Cora and take out at a restaurant nearby. When Patrick Clancy returned home, he found his then-wife sprawled on the ground, paralyzed from a two-story fall from their bedroom window, and the children dead and dying in the basement. Lindsay Clancy has pleaded not guilty on the grounds that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis at the time and can't be held criminally responsible. Her attorney, Kevin Reddington, called experts who diagnosed her with the condition, saying that Clancy heard a voice the night of the killings that told her to kill the children, then herself. More severe and rare than postpartum depression, postpartum psychosis is estimated to impact one out of every 500 women after birth. On Friday, jurors heard from the defense's last witness, Dr. Philip Resnick, a doctor who testified for Andrea Yates' successful insanity defense. Yates killed three of her children in 2001. After initially being found guilty, Yates argued she had postpartum psychosis during a retrial. She has been in a mental hospital ever since. She was clearly psychotic on that day, he said of Clancy, telling the jury that the auditory hallucinations she heard the day of the killings convinced her what she was doing was morally right. In her mind, he said, she believed that she would be doing her children a favor by having them go to heaven with her rather than remain on earth without her doing the mothering. But Mack, the first rebuttal witness, disagreed, saying that Clancy instead had major depressive disorder and showed that she could act lawfully and rationally in the hours leading up to the killings. Clancy drove Cora to and from a doctor's appointment that morning, built a snowman with the children, and researched children's medicine. He also pointed to a phrase Clancy told him she'd said to her children as she strangled them, "Go to God." To Mack, the utterance showed that Clancy knew her kids were innocent and that what she was doing was wrong. Not only was it a hope for the children, he said, it was a description of the situation. On Friday, Reddington drew attention to when the two doctors had examined his client. Resnick saw Clancy about 4 months after the killings. Mack examined her a few months ago. He also questioned Mack's credentials in the area of postpartum mental health. After Mack finishes his testimony, the prosecution is expected to call a few more expert witnesses. Judge William Sullivan had guessed that closing arguments could happen Tuesday or Wednesday, suggesting that he would be open to giving both sides some time in between the end of testimony and closing. Afterwards, Sullivan will instruct the jury. Currently, there have been 18 jurors sitting for the proceedings, which will be randomly narrowed down to 12 for the actual deliberations. Psychosis defense. What will jurors have to consider? Clancy's criminal responsibility defense carries specific jury instructions. By Colleen Cronin. Jurors in the Lindsay Clancy murder trial could start deliberating by the middle of this week. Because Clancy has already admitted to killing her children, the members of the jury aren't deciding if she committed acts, but rather whether she is criminally responsible for her kids' deaths. Judge William Sullivan told both parties that he'll be using the latest model jury instruction on criminal responsibility from the Supreme Judicial Court to form his own instructions. According to the SJC instructions, to find Clancy guilty, the Commonwealth has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was criminally responsible for the killings. Here's a few factors based on the SJC instructions that the jurors will have to consider. Did Clancy have a mental disease or defect at the time of the killings? That doesn't mean that Clancy had to have a specific diagnosis, the instructions say, although the disease or defect cannot include an abnormality characterized only by repeated criminal conduct. If the jurors determine that, yes, she did, they'll have to consider whether the disease or defect caused her to lack the capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of her acts or to conform her behavior to the law. An optional part of the model instructions allow the jurors to be aware that if Clancy is found guilty by reason of insanity and a court determines she's a danger to herself or others, she will be institutionalized after trial and re-examined at intervals for release. This section will only be read if the defense requests it or the judge deems it necessary and the defense doesn't object. Police union blasts DA's campaign cash vow. Middlesex DA signed 2020 promise not to take donations, endorsements from police unions, by Tim Dunn. Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan is facing blowback from a Massachusetts police union after the Herald revealed that she and former U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins signed a 2020 pledge promising to reject endorsements or campaign contributions from law enforcement unions. Middlesex County deserves a district attorney who is committed to fundamental fairness and ethics in applying the law, complete transparency in the office's operations, and working with law enforcement to obtain justice for victims and their families, said Massachusetts Coalition of Police, MassCop, President Scott Hovesplan. Marion Ryan has rejected police officers and their households as a constituency while aligning herself with an anti-law enforcement defund the police organization. MassCop has endorsed Ryan's opponent in the Democratic primary. Ryan and Rollins signed a pledge by the Justice Collaborative Institute, a progressive anti-police movement created in the wake of the death of George Floyd at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. They are featured on a list of other district attorneys across the country who signed the 2020 pledge on the now-defunct website dumpcopcash.com, which calls for DA candidates to promise to decline any campaign endorsements or contributions made by a law enforcement union. The Justice Collaborative has previously supported local and national policies to defund police departments and redistribute the funding towards social workers, according to Influence Watch, although defunding police was not part of the 2020 pledge signed by the pair. An archive of the website before it was shut down shows headshots of D.A. Ryan and then Suffolk D.A. Rollins as signatories, along with other notable Democratic counterparts in various districts across the U.S. As prosecutors, we play a fundamental role in the criminal legal system. How we act in that role affects both how the system operates and how people perceive how the system operates. Because of this, regardless of our actions in the past, we are joining others in committing that will not accept campaign endorsements or contributions from police unions going forward, the Justice Collaborative pledge reads. Campaign endorsements and contributions send a message. They tell citizens that the candidate, in this case a prosecutor, seeking election, aligns with the values and interests of the donor or endorser, and they create a perceived, if not actual, impression that the elected official is beholden to that group, it says. The pledge was signed in the weeks following Floyd's death, and as several violent and destructive protests over the incident erupted across major U.S. cities, including in Boston. These protests were paired with calls by prominent national Democrats supporting the Defund the Police movement, including Senator Ed Markey and Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, among others. In a recent interview with a local news outlet in Newton, Fig City News, Ryan attributed her lack of any endorsements from police unions this election cycle to her signing of the pledge. This as her primary opponent, Middlesex Assistant DA David Soleil, has massed endorsements from over 40 police unions across the state, including from MassCop. David greatly respects the work of police officers in the Commonwealth and, unlike DA Ryan, is unafraid to receive their support. He has also proven himself immune to the pressure and influence of anti-police organizations and their reckless calls to drain resources from law enforcement, Hovisplan said. MassCop represents over 6,000 Massachusetts police officers from more than 200 local departments. The Justice Collaborative pledge included other signatories from across the country with a troubled legal history, including former Baltimore District Attorney Marilyn Mosby, who was convicted of mortgage fraud and perjury in federal court in 2024. She had previously been convicted of perjury in a separate trial. Mosby was first elected in 2015, serving two terms before losing her re-election bid in 2022. Ryan's campaign did not immediately respond to a Herald request for comment. Veteran move. Flynn decries petty Boston City Hall politics amid leadership snafu, by Gayla Cawley. A Facebook post, later taken down by Councillor Henry Santana, got tongues wagging in Boston by suggesting Councillor Ed Flynn, a U.S. Navy veteran and critic of the mayor, was stripped of his Veterans Committee vice chairmanship. Santana's initial social media post, which was up all day Thursday and part of the day on Friday, per a source who shared a screenshot with the Herald, was advertising a Veterans, Military Families, and Military Affairs Committee hearing Santana is set to hold as chair of that council committee this week. The post advertised Flynn as the sponsor of the order that sparked the hearing, lung cancer rates among black veterans and services for women veterans. Listed instead of Flynn as vice chair, however, was Ben Weber. A new post by Santana later listed Flynn as vice chair, leading to speculation about whether this snafu was an innocent mistake or a matter of minds being changed at City Hall after community pushback. I'm uncertain as to my current status on the Veterans Committee, Flynn, who chaired the committee last term, told the Herald Friday. Regardless of my status, I will continue to play a leadership role in supporting veterans and military families in Boston and across Massachusetts and the nation. Flynn saw the move as being pushed by Mayor Michelle Wu, who is aligned with the majority of the council, including Santana, Weber, and Council President Liz Braden, who sets council committee assignments. I do understand the mayor's office was upset with my strong advocacy for veterans and military families across the city, and upset with me for calling out cuts to the Boston's Veterans Department that provides critical services and support to veterans, Flynn said. After public outcry, Wu restored her proposed $724,000 cut to the Veterans Services Office budget in May through a new $1 million public-private partnership with Brighton Marine, a local nonprofit. "We worked with Brighton Marine to get those funds back into the budget," Flynn said. "I'm going to continue to work hard on behalf of veterans and military families, regardless if I'm chair, vice chair, or not on the committee at all." Flynn also cited recent pushback he's received from Progressive Massachusetts after calling for the resignation of the group's political director, Jonathan Cohn, for criticizing State Senator Mike Rush on social media for his reelection campaign's lawn sign indicating his veteran status. "For me, providing effective services, programs, leadership, and outreach for veterans and military families is both personal and high priority," Flynn said. "I'm fortunate to be a member of a statewide veterans task force appointed by Governor Maura Healey and an active member of the Disabled American Veterans. Regardless of petty Boston City Hall politics, I will continue to provide the critical leadership needed to ensure veterans and military families are treated with the respect and dignity they deserve and earned," Flynn added. Braden, the council president, said through a spokesperson Friday that she has not removed Flynn from his post as vice chair of the council veterans committee. "Councillor Flynn is a tireless and devoted advocate for Boston's veterans, and the council president is deeply appreciative of his efforts as vice chair," Braden's chief of staff, Matt Costas, said in a statement to the Herald. When initially reached by the Herald Friday, Weber said he wasn't aware of any changes to install him as vice chair of the Veterans Committee and that he would look into it. Moments later, he said Santana's social media post listing him as vice chair was a typo, and I was told they took the post down. Flynn said he doesn't buy the explanation from his colleagues after being informed of their remarks by the Herald. He said a lot of veterans reached out to him about Santana's social media post and believes that pushback led City Hall leadership to change their minds about removing him. Gregory Maynard, executive director of the Boston Policy Institute, said if Braden had been moving to remove Flynn from his committee vice chairmanship, it would have been significant because midterm council leadership replacements are uncommon. "The only times that we've seen chairs be removed was over, like, real issues," Maynard told the Herald Friday. "Arroyo was credibly accused of rape, and TFA, Tanya Fernandez Anderson, was indicted for federal corruption charges. Ex-counselor Ricardo Arroyo was stripped of his council committee leadership by then-council president Flynn in 2022 after his decades-old sexual assault allegations resurfaced in the media. Arroyo was never charged. Last year, then-council president Ruth Z. Lejeune stripped counselor Tanya Fernandez Anderson of her council leadership positions after she agreed to plead guilty to federal corruption charges tied to a City Hall kickback scheme. "Like, what's Ed Flynn done wrong?" Maynard said. "The mayor really, really doesn't like him? If that qualifies you to get thrown off the committees, why do he or Aaron Murphy have anything?" "If Flynn really was removed," Maynard added, "this shows the degree of control and reach into the body by Mayor Wu." Pot shop extortion trial set to start. Suffolk sheriff charged with using his job to get in and out of $50,000 stock deal by Colleen Cronin. Embattled Suffolk Sheriff Stephen Tompkins' extortion trial is set to start Monday in federal court. Prosecutors allege that Tompkins used his role as a top law enforcement official to pressure a cannabis company into selling him $50,000 worth of pre-IPO stock. Tompkins has denied the charges, with his attorney, Martin Weinberg, writing, "It was a business transaction at full market value with a longtime friend that had nothing to do with Mr. Tompkins' official position." According to the government's trial brief, an executive at the National Cannabis Company, called Ascend, applied for a license to dispense weed in Massachusetts in 2019 and used a partnership with the Suffolk County Sheriff's Department, signed off by Tompkins, to get approval from the Cannabis Control Commission. Then, sometime in 2020, Tompkins began asking Ascend executive Francis Perullo to sell him stock in the company before it was set to go public, prosecutors said. The government alleged that after Perullo rebuffed him, Tompkins reminded the exec that his company would need to continue the program with the sheriff's department to maintain their license in Massachusetts. Perullo eventually sold Tompkins the stock over fears not doing so would jeopardize the company, according to prosecutors. Despite an agreement that Tompkins bore the risk of the investment, a year or two after the sale of the stock, the sheriff demanded Perullo give him a full refund, even though the stock had depreciated below the initial $50,000 buy-in, the government's briefing said. Weinberg plans to argue, according to his own briefing, that none of the evidence indicates that the exec feared economic loss, writing the businessman's mere subjective belief that Mr. Tompkins was being persistent in his requests does not amount to extortion as a matter of law. Tompkins never believed that his request to purchase stock or to sell stock or receive a refund were wrongful or willful or knowingly in violation of the law, Weinberg continued. According to court documents, text messages and emails between Tompkins and Perullo are uncontested exhibits in the case. Perullo is also on the government's witness list. The trial is set to begin at 9 a.m. before Judge Myong J. Jun at the John J. Moakley Courthouse in Boston. Musicians BSO Extend Contract Talks by Grace Sokovich. The Boston Symphony Orchestra and Boston Musicians Association Union agreed to a 48-hour extension of its current labor agreement Sunday after the union voted to authorize a strike over the weekend as their contract was about to expire, according to the BSO. I am writing to share that today the Boston Symphony Orchestra, the Boston Musicians Union, and the Boston Symphony Orchestra Players Committee agreed to a 48-hour extension of its current labor agreement, valid until 11:59 p.m. on Tuesday, August 25, 2026, BSO CEO Chad Smith said Sunday. A ratification vote is pending. The union, representing over 90 Boston Symphony Orchestra musicians, voted Saturday to authorize what would be the first strike in the orchestra's 145-year history ahead of the planned expiration of their three-year contract on 11:59 p.m. Sunday. The strike vote signaled the members could begin a labor stoppage if negotiations continued to fail. The BMA did not verify the extension ratification vote or respond to a request for comment on Sunday. In a statement Saturday, the union noted strained relations with the BSO since the decision to oust longtime music director Andres Nelsons next summer after 13 seasons. In spite of the turmoil of the last 6 months caused by BSO's leadership decision to terminate the orchestra's musical director, Andres Nelsons, they have failed to agree to a collective bargaining agreement that would begin to restore the trust that they have destroyed and offer a fair contract to the musicians who are at the heart and soul of the BSO, the union said Saturday, adding that management had not agreed to a mediator put forth at the time. Thank you for your continued support and engagement during this period, Smith said. I look forward to sharing updates in the coming days. The Boston Symphony Orchestra's season is scheduled to open September 17th. Sunny and cooler temps on tap, potentially wet weekend ahead. Boston is likely to start off the week with a bout of seasonable, sunny, late summer weather before a potentially pretty wet weekend, according to National Weather Service forecasts. The good news is the next few days here, there may be some spotty showers, mostly in interior parts of Massachusetts, but most areas end up being really dry until we get to, like, Thursday, said NWS meteorologist Andrew Locanto. The other big thing that's going to change for our weather pattern here during the early to middle part of this upcoming week is it's going to feel a lot less humid and temperatures will be a little more seasonable, more typical of late summer, early fall. Monday and Tuesday are expected to start off the week with high temperatures right around 80 degrees, forecasts show, and mostly sunny to sunny skies. The nighttime is forecasted to dip into a breezy, cool low around the low 60s. Wednesday and Thursday are likely to see more sunny or mostly sunny skies as temperatures warm slightly closer to a high around the low to mid 80s, NWS forecasts. The first few days could see some spot showers outside of the Boston area, mostly west of Worcester, Locanto said, but should remain really pleasant overall, seasonable. Most of the first 4 days of the week here are pretty uneventful, which is good, Locanto said. It gets more unsettled, though, as we move toward that later week and into the weekend. Unfortunately, this weekend looking pretty wet, so that's not great for those with outdoor plans. A chance of shower shows up late Thursday night as skies turn mostly cloudy and continues into Friday, forecast state. Friday is expected to be partly sunny with a high in the low to mid 80s and a chance of rain throughout the day, NWS states. Preliminary forecasts show more highs in the upper 70s to low 80s into the weekend. There appear to be no standout weather hazards through the week, Locanto said, but for a high risk of rip currents around Nantucket early in the week. If you're venturing to the beach, especially south-facing on Nantucket those days, you're more vulnerable to seeing some dangerous rip currents, said Locanto. And we do want to message that, too, because we've had a couple of rip current fatalities, unfortunately, over the summer months here. So we just want to give that extra awareness. IndyCar race roars through the Capitol. Trump waves green flag to start Freedom 250 Grand Prix. From the Associated Press. Washington. For once, things were moving fast in the nation's capital. Washington was hosting an IndyCar race through its streets Sunday, with President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania Trump kicking off the Freedom 250 Grand Prix by leading a slow lap in the presidential limousine through the course. Soon after, the president waved the green flag to start the race, and drivers began whipping through downtown, including a stretch along Pennsylvania Avenue, not too far from the White House. I'm going to make a little circle in a nice, secure car, slightly slower than the ones we're going to witness, but we're going to have fun, Trump said in an interview on Fox shortly before the ride. The open-wheel race, with cars whizzing past Washington monuments at speeds approaching 200 miles per hour, is the latest of Trump's celebrations this year to mark America's 250th birthday. Trump's other events to mark the semi-quincentennial of the Declaration of Independence signing have included a UFC fight on the White House lawn, military aircraft flyovers, a massive July 4th fireworks show on the National Mall, and a Great American State Fair that the president headlined after scores of 90s area musical acts dropped out. The events have all had a Trumpian flair, featuring appearances from his friends and the aim of showcasing spectacle, Americana, and power. In this latest case, it was horsepower. Sunday included some of Trump's favorite flourishes, One of his favorite singers, tenor Christopher Macchio, performed the Star Spangled Banner. A trained bald eagle was dramatically released near the start line, and it swooped and flew overhead before returning to its handler. There were flyovers of military aircraft which have boomed over the city during the July 4th celebrations, among other events. One flyover Sunday involved a formation featuring a B-2 stealth bomber, which Trump frequently boasts about for its role in dropping massive bunker buster bombs on Iranian nuclear facilities last year. Air Force One, escorted by four fighter jets, flew overhead as Trump did his lap. The jet was the Qatar-gifted aircraft that the president has been using as Air Force One, which has attracted scrutiny not only for Trump's acceptance of the luxury gift, but because it is not equipped with some of the same missile detection and countermeasure systems found on older presidential jets. Iran official says support of new sanctions would be an act of war by the Associated Press. The new head of Iran's top security body warned Sunday that Tehran will see any country's support for new U.S. economic measures against the Islamic Republic as an act of war, while Iran's president defended a memorandum of understanding with the United States as the best way out of the stalled conflict. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent on Monday is expected to announce the new measures after the U.S. vowed to impose an unprecedented level of economic warfare and isolation on a country that has lived for decades under sanctions. Also, Monday, Pakistan's army chief is expected to visit Iran as mediators try to revive talks. Meanwhile, attacks calmed on the Strait of Hormuz, but posturing did not, as a recently created Iranian authority listed dozens of vessels it said will face restrictions on future transits. The hardline leader of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Mohsen Rezai, issued his latest warning on X, with the comments quickly shared by Iranian state media. It came a day after Rezai's most extensive public comments since being named to the post this month. If Trump wants to do something, we will retaliate in a seismic manner, he had told the state broadcaster in an interview that aired late Saturday. He said Iran would target other oil shipping routes from the Persian Gulf, alternatives to the Strait of Hormuz. Rezai, a former Revolutionary Guard commander and military advisor to Supreme Leader Ayatollah Mojtaba Khamenei, was part of senior appointments widely seen as hardening Tehran's political and military stance. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian, earlier Sunday, said the memorandum of understanding signed in mid-June was the best way to move beyond a situation of neither war nor peace, adding that Tehran can't attract investment nearly 6 months after the war began. There is not a single provision in this agreement that amounts to capitulation, Pezeshkian said in a speech published by state-run IRNA. The Supreme Leader sets the policies and we will follow that path. The interim deal opened a 60-day period for talks aimed at ending the war and reaching an accord on Iran's nuclear program. That period ended last week with no signs of compromise or extension. There were no confirmed attacks on the Strait of Hormuz over the past 48 hours, a multinational coalition overseen by the U.S. Navy said Sunday, with shipping traffic still at reduced levels. The U.S. military said its blockade of Iranian ports had redirected 70 commercial ships and disabled three as of Sunday. Iran's recently created Persian Gulf Strait Authority, sanctioned by the U.S., published a list of dozens of ships it said had violated arrangements for transiting the strait and would face future restrictions like fines or seizures. The strait had been considered an international waterway before the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran on February 28th. Iran and Oman, on the strait's other side, are now discussing the management of it, which likely will include ships paying fees. Pakistani Field Marshal Asim Munir will lead a delegation to Tehran on Monday, Iranian state television reported, citing Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson, Esmail Baghaei. Two regional officials said the visit was part of Islamabad's efforts to de-escalate tensions between the United States and Iran and urged them to return to the negotiating table. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. The Iranian judiciary's Mizan news agency reported the latest execution connected to nationwide protests early this year, saying Majid Adineh was arrested January 9th in Mohammadshahr, west of Tehran. The judiciary said forensic examinations indicated the handgun found on him had been fired on January 8th and 9th. Mizan said Adina had joined the unrest following calls by groups opposed to Iran's government and alleged that he had received training from groups outside the country. He was convicted under Iran's law imposing harsher penalties for espionage and cooperation with hostile states. Police arrested a 16-year-old boy from the Israeli settlement of Avigavil in the beating of a 61-year-old Palestinian, Saeed Muhammad Ibrahim Rabah, outside his home in the occupied West Bank a year after he lost a leg after being shot by a settler. Rabah told the Associated Press that the violence at his home on Saturday was an effort to make families leave, but we will remain no matter what happens. Separately, the West Bank Health Ministry said a 14-year-old in the Asghar refugee camp in Nablus was shot dead by Israeli forces, who did not immediately comment. The uncle of Islam Mahir Ajouri, Nihad Ajouri, called the shooting indiscriminate. And Israel's military said it detained a suspect in a stabbing attack that wounded a 24-year-old Israeli man in the area of Al-Aju in the West Bank. Israel's emergency services said the man was in moderate condition. 4-year-old Mohammed Taha died after an Israeli airstrike hit a central Gaza house on Sunday and wounded at least 5 others, according to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, which received the casualties. Israel's military later said it struck and killed a Hamas commander in central Gaza. The hospital confirmed that the man named was killed. An Israeli strike in southern Gaza wounded at least 7 people, including 3 children, according to health officials at Nasser Hospital. The military did not immediately comment. And Defense Minister Israel Katz said in a statement that he instructed the military to act immediately and forcefully to prevent launches of balloons, kites, or drones from Gaza toward nearby Israeli communities. Flynn calls for probe after wrong ballot report. City voters were immediately provided proper ballots by Gray Sokovich. City Councilor Ed Flynn called for an independent investigation Sunday related to an alleged wrong ballot incident during primary election early voting over the weekend, leading city election officials to state an issue affecting some voters was rectified immediately. On the first day of early voting, the city identified isolated incidents of human error by a poll worker, and the affected voters were immediately provided the proper ballots and voted successfully, a Boston Election Department spokesperson said. In-person early voting for the state primary election kicked off in Boston on Saturday, August 22nd, and will continue through Friday, August 28th. Any registered voters in Boston can vote early in person at any of a number of voting sites, including City Hall, without any excuse or reason necessary. In an ex post Sunday morning, Flynn noted the early voting issue in South Boston. I can confirm some Boston residents that went to vote yesterday at the Condon School in South Boston as part of the early voting program received the wrong ballot to cast their vote, Flynn stated, tagging the Boston Elections Department. We now need an independent investigation to ensure every vote actually counts. The incident reportedly took place when a poll worker with a decade of experience at the South Boston polling site misread the precinct number as the ballot label number. Early voting sites serve a citywide population, meaning poll workers follow protocols to distribute 34 types of ballots in multiple languages available at each location based on voters' registered voting addresses. Based on a city-run ballot inventory review for the site, the number of voter check-ins reportedly matched the number and type of voted ballots in all cases. The city department works with the Secretary of State's office on elections. The Boston Election Department did not directly address Flynn's call for an independent investigation. During early voting, registered voters in Boston can vote in person at any of the early votes locations across the city, the election department spokesperson said. Voting has never been easier in Boston, whether by mail, at early voting sites available through Friday, August 28th, or on primary election day, Tuesday, September 1st. We encourage all Bostonians to exercise their right to vote. The September 1st state primary election includes races between Suffolk District Attorney candidates incumbent Kevin Hayden, former DA Rachel Rollins, and Linda Champion, Democratic U.S. Senate candidates incumbent Ed Markey, and Representative Seth Moulton, and Republican gubernatorial candidates Mike Minogue and Brian Shortsleeve. More information on early voting locations and hours is available at boston.gov/early voting. Man, child killed in North Reading crash, by Colleen Cronin. North Reading police arrested a suspect in a deadly crash that killed two on Saturday night, according to officials. Matthew Sweeney, 21, of Paxton, faces charges of felony motor vehicle homicide, operating under the influence and operating to endanger, North Reading Police Chief Mark Zimmerman and Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan said in a joint statement. A preliminary investigation indicated that around 10:45 p.m., Sweeney was driving an Acura MDX at a high rate of speed when he crashed into a Honda stopped at a red light, the statement said. The crash caused the Honda to go up in flames. Despite the efforts of first responders and a Good Samaritan to get occupants out of the vehicle, a man and a child died on the scene, officials said. The victims have not been identified, and it was not clear if there were other people in the Honda at the time of the crash. Sweeney was taken into custody at the scene and is expected to be arraigned at Woburn District Court Monday, the statement said. Officials noted that the investigation into the crash is ongoing. From the business pages, Bitcoin gold break slumps. Investors boost alternative assets amid frantic activity in bond market, from the Associated Press. Bitcoin and gold shot higher last week, with both getting a boost from some frantic action surrounding the bond market, and the cryptocurrency also benefiting from activity in Washington. Bitcoin had dropped from a January high of around $95,000 to below $60,000 at the end of June. Investors shied away from speculative assets earlier in the year, and crypto supporters were concerned about the lack of movement on proposed regulation of the industry. On Friday, Bitcoin rose above $77,000. Gold hit a high above $5,300 in January, but dropped to around $4,000 in June as rising rates made interest-bearing investments more attractive. Gold rose to $4,661 on Friday. The first jolt arrived Wednesday when the Treasury Department announced plans to significantly increase its buybacks of long-term treasuries or government debt. On the same day, President Donald Trump, who made about $1.2 billion last year from various crypto holdings, urged Congress to move quickly on crypto legislation. There was an almost immediate reaction, which included a dollar sell-off and a jump in the value of gold and Bitcoin as investors moved toward alternative assets. In a surprise announcement Wednesday, the U.S. Treasury Department said that it would at least double the size of its planned purchase of longer-term government debt. The maneuver was intended to calm bond markets after a sustained sell-off, meaning investors were asking for higher yields to lend money to the U.S., which investors suddenly viewed as riskier. That's because while the Treasury intervention worked, at least for a short period, it also raised questions about whether the government is trying to push borrowing costs lower despite inflationary pressures. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is attempting to lower long-term borrowing costs, a move that can put upward pressure on inflation at a time when inflation is already elevated. Bessent's maneuver could handcuff the Federal Reserve, which fights inflation by raising interest rates. Then there's the national debt, which surpassed a record $40 trillion on the same day that the Treasury's actions unfolded. The milestone figure was recorded just 5 months after the U.S. hit a record $39 trillion debt in March. It reached $38 trillion 5 months before that, in October. There's already a lot of anxiety over inflation, particularly because of the conflict in Iran and soaring energy prices. If yields on U.S. bonds are not truly reflecting risk, you can often see that play out in the value of the U.S. currency, which took a significant downward swoop Wednesday. So where does the money that was invested in the dollar or treasuries go? This week, it appears to have been funneled into what is known as the debasement trade, when investors flood into alternative assets such as gold, which rose more than 2% Wednesday. The debasement trade now includes Bitcoin. Bitcoin jumped more than 20% this week. From the sports pages, Vrabel makes telling admission about Pat's roster. New England has suffered several injuries in preseason. By Doug Kayed, Andrew Callahan, and Greg Dudek. Foxborough. Don't be surprised if the Patriots rest their starters all preseason. It sounds like head coach Mike Vrabel is concerned about losing any more key players during the exhibition slate. In answering a question about whether Drake May and the rest of the Patriots starters would play in Thursday's preseason finale against the Browns, Vrabel made a revealing concession about his team after Saturday's preseason win over the Eagles. "I do not think we have a very deep team, so I think we have to make sure that we are preparing our football team and that we are doing everything that we can to keep our best players available," Vrabel said. "And if that means playing Thursday as part of preparation, then that is what we will do. I have not made that decision yet, but I would say that that is something that I am confident in with where we are set up currently." The Patriots have seen two key backup offensive linemen go down with injuries in consecutive preseason games. Backup center guard Ben Brown suffered an injury in last week's tie with the Colts that will keep him out the rest of the preseason. Backup offensive tackle Marcus Bryant suffered an ankle injury in Saturday's win and was quickly ruled out with the injury. "I think he just got rolled up on," Vrabel said of Bryant. "I think it will be a lower leg injury, but I do not know to what extent. That is kind of what happens sometimes in those inside plays. So we will have to just take a look and see where he is at, but I will not know anything right now. Patriots running back Trevion Henderson, rookie tight end Eli Raridan, and safety Kevin Byard all didn't dress for Saturday's game. Vrabel was asked after the game if those were injury situations. I would say that those are individual situations that kept them out of the pregame warm-up, Vrabel said. It wasn't all that long ago the Patriots packaged 3 draft picks to trade up for Gabe Jackus. After 2 preseason games, Vrabel and his coaching staff are still figuring out what the second-round rookie pass rusher can do. For now, Vrabel sounds sure of one thing when reflecting on Jackus' NFL performances thus far. Just still inconsistent, Vrabel said after Saturday's preseason win over the Eagles. I think that the effort is certainly there. The willingness is. He's a very coachable player. We are just putting a lot on him right now as far as special teams and covering kicks and playing on kick return. We have to be able to see what he can do and what we feel like we can count on when the regular season comes. Jackus, a prototypical edge defender at 6'4" and 261 pounds, missed virtually all of the team's spring practices and meetings after undergoing a knee procedure that led to prolonged contract negotiations with the team. Once he signed days into training camp, Jackus spent a few days in the facility ramping up into football shape and participated in his practice August 1st. Jackus was disappointed with several mistakes against the Colts last week and got flagged for a roughing the passer penalty versus the Eagles, but Vrabel is nonetheless optimistic about the rookie. I think he will just continue to improve because he has that type of attitude and he's willing, and I know he will get back to work real quick, Vrabel said. Baron Morton learned NFL players are faster than Texas high schoolers on Saturday night. Morton, a quarterback by trade, was called on to serve as an emergency punter during Saturday night's preseason win over the Eagles. Morton said Saturday night that he hadn't punted in a game since high school. At halftime, he said he got some pointers from Patriots punter Bryce Berenger, who Vrabel said wasn't feeling great, because the Eagles' punt block team was coming faster than he had experienced punting at Eastland, Texas High School, and it kind of caught him by surprise. Well, I just assume all the quarterbacks, they do their little punt thing and can see how close they can get it to the goal line, so I figured he could punt, Vrabel said. Bryce wasn't feeling great after the first 2 punts, so I figured instead of risking anything there with Bryce or with Andy, that Baron was able to get us out of there. Morton punted 3 times for 133 yards. Morton, who finished Saturday's game 13 of 17 passing for 129 yards, also led the Patriots on a game-winning drive and fourth quarter comeback at quarterback, hitting rookie wide receiver Nick DeGennaro for a 37-yard touchdown with less than a minute left. Morton said he was the backup punter during his time at Texas Tech. He also punted and kicked at his pro day to show teams what he could offer. It's been an underwhelming spring for the most part for Patriots backup running back Lan Larrison. Larrison saw any grip he might have on the Patriots' 3rd running back spot, which is one of a few position battles taking place this summer, slip in New England's preseason opener last week against the Indianapolis Colts. Given another chance Saturday night against the Philadelphia Eagles that he should hold the position, Larrison seized his opportunity. Larrison was one of the Patriots' more productive skill players against the Eagles. The 2025 undrafted free agent out of UC Davis finished with 9 carries for 33 yards with a rushing touchdown in the fourth quarter and also added 3 receptions for 41 yards. I feel like Lan certainly had a good performance, a gritty, tough performance tonight, and did some really good things, Vrabel said. Near the end of the first quarter in Saturday's preseason game against the Eagles, Vrabel called a timeout for a simple reason. I saw, expletive, defense, Vrabel said, and I wanted to talk to them, and I figured that if I did not call a timeout that I would not be able to get what I wanted to say off my chest. So Vrabel gathered his defense after he had allowed a long run that brought Philadelphia's offense into the red zone and gave the unit a piece of his mind. 6 plays later, the Eagles scored a touchdown anyway to cap a bruising 13-play, 77-yard march. Back on the sideline, Vrabel barked again at his defense. This is what he said, according to third-year Patriots safety Del Pettis, that he would play guys who are going to go out there and fight and challenge, not just let things happen, Pettis said. The defense was very leaky, in my opinion, in the first half. Like throughout the whole course of the defense, we weren't standing up to the Eagles. Despite the uneven results, the Patriots' defense forced punts on the Eagles' next 2 possessions, but allowed another touchdown just before the half, and harsh tone, Pettis appreciated Vrabel's messaging. Bennett settles down, Sox rally to sweep Giants. It looked at first like it was going to be a long day for Jake Bennett. The rookie left-hander already surpassed his career high in innings pitched as a professional, and in order to help manage his workload, the Sox opted to push his next start back, so when he took the mound Sunday, he'd be doing so on 8 days' rest. The early returns weren't good, but before long, Bennett locked back in and gave his offense a chance to make their move. Bennett shook off a rough first 2 innings and finished brilliantly in Sunday's 5-4 win over the San Francisco Giants, allowing 3 earned runs in 7 innings to help complete the 3-game home sweep. The offense also rallied from 3 runs down, scoring 5 unanswered, including 3 in the 4th, to take the lead for good. That was really, really good to see him make some adjustments after the first couple of innings, because there was even some loud outs in the first couple, Red Sox interim manager Chad Tracy said. But once he got settled, he looked like the Jake Bennett we've seen most of the year. Following the game, Tracy said all 3 of the club's rehabbing players came out of their Sunday games feeling well, and that all will get reassessed Monday over the minor league off day. Yet while Trevor Story and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa could potentially be activated as soon as Tuesday, Roman Anthony will definitely play at least 1 more minor league game in Worcester. Roman will continue in Worcester next week, we know that for sure, Tracy said post-game. So we'll see how everybody feels coming in tomorrow after playing a good bit this weekend, and we'll go from there. Yankees 6, Blue Jays 3. Ben Rice hit a bases-loaded single to score 2 runs and cap a 3-run 6th inning, and the New York Yankees pulled away for an 8-3 victory over the Toronto Blue Jays on Sunday. The Yankees knocked out Toronto star Jose Soriano by opening the 6th with 3 straight singles, including a bunt by Jazz Chisholm Jr. that loaded the bases. After Braden Fisher got the first 2 outs, Trent Grisham took a 3-2 slider that was low and inside for a go-ahead walk. Rays 3, Orioles 1. Nick Martinez pitched 6 innings of 1-hit ball. Junior Caminero and Chandler Simpson delivered RBI singles in the pivotal 6th inning, and the Tampa Bay Rays beat the Baltimore Orioles 3-1 Sunday to avoid a 3-game sweep. The AL East leading Rays had lost 3 straight and 7 of 9 before bouncing back behind Martinez, who retired 18 of the 19 batters he faced. The only flaw in his brilliant performance was Colton Cowser's 3rd-inning double down the right field line. Marlins 6, Nationals 2. Xavier Edwards hit a go-ahead 2-run single in the 5th inning, and the Miami Marlins beat the Washington Nationals 6-2 on Sunday to complete a 3-game series sweep. Otto Lopez had 2 walks and hit a sacrifice fly, while Joe Mack doubled and had 2 RBIs for the Marlins, who are 41-25 at home. White Sox 2, Mets 1. Tristan Peters homered with 1 out in the 9th inning to give the Chicago White Sox a 2-1 victory over the New York Mets on Sunday. After the Mets tied it in the top of the inning, Peters drove a pitch from Kodai Senga 406 feet into the center field seats to seal Chicago's 11th walk-off victory this season and second of the series. It was Peter's third walk-off hit of the season. Rangers 6, Angels 3. Ezequiel Duran and Elias Diaz hit solo homers. Cal Quantrill worked 6 scoreless innings. And the Texas Rangers beat the Los Angeles Angels 5-3 on Sunday. With the win, the Rangers moved into a tie with the Houston Astros for